Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Happy Friday morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on 91.5 KJZZ in Phoenix with Lauren Gilger. I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up this hour, some lawmakers want to tighten up the permanent early voting list, and we'll take the stage to learn about the life of a dreamer and Cassius Clay.
But first, Hacienda Healthcare announced yesterday that it's closing its intermediate care facility, or ICF. That's the unit where a 29-year-old woman with severe disabilities was raped and later gave birth to a baby boy in December. The news has alarmed state agencies that say they're committed to a path forward. And joining me this morning to talk more about this is KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie. She's been following the story since it broke. Good morning, Kathy.
And good morning, Lauren.
So we know Hacienda is shuttering this facility. Do we know when?
We don't. First, the board of directors voted to close the ICF last Friday. In a statement sent last evening, Hacienda says it's been working with state agencies to develop a plan to help the state transition those ICF patients to other facilities. I reached out to the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System, or ACCESS, and the Department of Economic Security, and they appear to be stunned by this announcement. DES called it disturbing news, and Governor Doug Ducey's spokesperson called it concerning. So while the agencies knew about the vote, I was told that Hacienda only provided verbal notification of their decision to close, and that doesn't constitute official notification. This morning, I got a copy of a letter ACCESS sent to Tom Pomeroy, the board's president, with several questions that Hacienda has so far failed to address. So we'll have to see about that. The letter did state clearly that it does not consent to the ICF ceasing operations, and it gave Hacienda two options. One, come into compliance and retain a third-party manager, which they were supposed to do. Or two, enter into an agreement with the Arizona Department of Health Services to allow DHS to exercise licensing authority over the ICF.
Okay. Do we know yet where these patients could end up with this announcement of the closure? Like, my understanding is there are not a lot of options for people in this kind of, who require this level of care.
Yeah, that's the tough part. For many of these residents, Hacienda is the only home they've ever known. Also, this population is medically fragile, and moving them could negatively impact those individuals, I'm told. So ACCESS and DES will reach out to families about options. What those might be, it's not yet clear. I talked to John Myers, who's the executive director of the ARC of Arizona, about this, and here's what he had to say.
They could be transferred to the facility, the institution at Coolidge, Arizona Training Program at Coolidge, which has an ICF. The problem is the ICF at Coolidge has not accepted new residents for a number of years. And so as the existing residents have died, that program has been scaled down. And it's, in my opinion anyway, it would not be at a point where it could accept the influx of 36 new patients in order to accommodate them. I mean, it's not staffed for it.
Now, Myers did say there's a handful of ICFs scattered around the state, Lauren, but they're small. Mm-hmm. So, again, we're talking about more than three dozen people who require round-the-clock care.
Okay. So, circling back to the vote to close then, did Hacienda's board indicate why they decided to pursue this path instead of working with the state to resolve its issues?
Yeah. In their statement, the board said that after careful consideration, they decided it was not sustainable to operate the ICF. However, Hacienda will continue to operate its skilled nursing facility.
All right. Lots to watch for there. Thank you, KJZZ's. That's KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie. Thanks.
Thanks, Lauren.
One of the central voices in the aftermath of this tragedy has been Democratic State Representative Jennifer Longden. She was about to start her first term in office when the news broke about the birth of this baby boy at Hacienda, and it hit home. Longden was shot in 2004 in a random drive-by shooting that left her paralyzed. It changed the course of her life. She went from successful businesswoman to losing her health insurance and struggling to stay afloat. She has been an advocate for disability rights ever since. And when the Hacienda story came to light, she knew she had to take action.
You know, we tend to use words like unthinkable and unspeakable. And until we do think of it and speak of it, especially within this body, the House and the Senate, then folks are going to continue to need relief, need help. And so we must speak of it. We must think of it, and we must act.
I met her yesterday in the members' lounge of the House of Representatives as she was in between votes, and we began by talking about her initial reaction to this Hacienda case. Unlike most of us, Longden was angry, but she was not necessarily surprised.
As a person who lives with a disability, and I've spent time in residential facilities, I wasn't shocked to know about it. I was certainly, like everyone else, saddened, sickened, angered, but I'm not surprised. We know that this happens with a high level of frequency to individuals with disabilities or vulnerable adults. So our seniors, children who live in residential facilities also face abuse at higher levels than one would see in the typically able population.
So this really kind of threw the issue of disability rights and advocacy into the spotlight and the abuse of people with disabilities, like you said. You've been an advocate for this for a long time. I wonder if you can see this in any way as, at least if there's anything that's good to come out of this, an opportunity to have this conversation.
It's hard to say something good is coming out of something so horrific, but this particular incident and the coverage of it certainly did, you know, rip the cover off of this issue at an important time. And I think that my being here in the legislature at this moment allowed me to speak to this as an issue in a way that others perhaps weren't prepared to do. You know, I'm already deeply connected into this community, and so I already knew where to go and who to talk to and how to plug in. I'm grateful that so many other legislators are working on this. You know, I'm having the great privilege of working directly with Senator Carter. I've had conversations with Senator Bartow. I've talked with Senator Brophy McGee. Many of my colleagues on both sides of the aisle have been really very invested in this as an issue.
I want to talk about some of the legislation that's being proposed in a moment, but first let's talk about the gaps that you think exist. Like, when you look at the way the system functions now, how is it possible that this happened, I guess, to begin with? Like, are there things that are obvious things that need to be changed?
So it's not how is it possible that it happened, because when you look at the system, you see that it's rife for opportunities for these types of abuses. So we have brought stakeholders together. There have been stakeholders meeting on this before Hacienda came to light. And, you know, we've uncovered several issues that I think we can work on right away. Senator Carter is dealing with the carve-out that happened some years ago for ICF intermediate care facilities. I have bills that we're going to be introducing on education around abuse and how mandated reporting works, because we have a different standard for mandated reporting for vulnerable adults compared to mandated reporting for children. And because of that, there are opportunities for people to slip through the cracks. So we're looking to fix that. APS, not the electric company, Adult Protective Services, is not a 24-hour service. It's only available during business hours, regular business hours. So if an assault happens to a vulnerable adult at the end of the work week and we're going into a long holiday weekend, there is no one to respond until Tuesday. We have to do better. We have vulnerable adults who rely on us for their well-being, for their dignity, and for their care, for their safety. And we must do better for these people who rely on us.
That's one of the things I wanted to ask you about, was the difference between the way the system approaches vulnerable adults versus vulnerable children, and how different the regulations are there and the laws are there and protections are there. Why do you think that is?
So I don't want in any way to convey or send a message that adults with disabilities or our seniors are not able to exercise their own agency. With that said, when adults find themselves in vulnerable situations, we're not prepared from a policy stance to offer them the assistance they need, because we see them as adults, and they are adults. And so there's this divide, there's this imbalance that we need to address.
The other one I want to talk about is your bill to create a position that's like an ADA coordinator statewide. Lots of cities have this. What do you think adding a statewide coordinator would do?
Well, this is to reinstate the statewide ADA coordinator. We had one many years ago, and Governor Brewer eliminated the position, along with many at that level, when we had our economic turndown during the Great Recession. One of the things that I think happened, because we don't have a statewide ADA coordinator, is a few years ago we had those frivolous lawsuits that hurt small business, and while they were hurting small business, they also hurt the disability community. So I believe that had this position been in place during that time, that that individual would have had the broader view to see this coming and work with small businesses to help them avoid the extortion lawsuits that came out of that.
You also have a bill that is sort of like a patient's bill of rights equivalent, but it's for victims of sexual assault. What is it you're trying to accomplish there?
Well, once again, Arizona does not fund comprehensive rape crisis services. And so while there is a patchwork of services available for individuals who experience sexual assault, and let's talk about what that is. That's 1 in 6 men, 1 in 4 women, and if you have a disability, it's 4 out of 5 people. So this is a big issue and one that needs to be dealt with. So there is a backlog of rape crisis kits. There is a lack of understanding of what one's rights or options are as a victim of sexual assault. And until we have comprehensive rape crisis services, I'm hoping this is one of the things that we can do to help solve that issue and bring some relief to people who have been victimized in horrible ways.
When you look at the broader system and the issues that this case has brought to light, what do you think needs to change on a broader level?
Well, I think that we do need to create awareness. We do need to create a framework of policy and law to ensure that people don't fall through the cracks. And education is an important component. In terms of the sexual assault matter that we now refer to as Hacienda, I have a bill that is currently being worked on. I'm looking for co-sponsors right now, and that will address education. And it will seek to get the appropriate stakeholders to the table and in the process work to define what sexual assault looks like, especially in individuals who receive intimate care. That line can get blurred and you're unsure where it is. So define what sexual assault looks like, how to recognize the signs, what to do if you suspect it, and where to go if you need help. And that's one of the biggest things I think we can do.
Representative Jennifer Longden, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lauren. I've appreciated our time together.
State Senator Michelle Ugenti-Rita is taking aim at another aspect of voting in Arizona. One of her proposals could result in voters being removed from the permanent early voting list, and that generated some passionate testimony before a Senate committee this week. Arizona Capital Times reporter Ben Giles is with us to discuss it. Ben, good morning.
Good morning.
So at its core, what would these changes do? And is there a need to actually have new legislation to do this?
Well, the first change that she proposed has to do with blocking people from turning in their ballots by hand. That's the mail-in ballots that people who sign up for the permanent early voting list, I'm going to call it PEVL. And it allows people who get those ballots in the mail to take their time with them and not necessarily mail them back to election officials in enough time so that they can get through the Postal Service and be counted. You can drop off your ballot at any voting site, even the day of the election. And what Ugenti-Rita's bill sought to do is require voters who get that ballot by mail to mail it back. And if not, you would have to go vote in person and cast a traditional ballot at the polling place.
And so when it comes to PEVL, as we're moving forward with this, there was some interesting testimony before Judiciary Chair Eddie Farnsworth's committee. I wonder if we could talk a little bit about that as well. It seems as though Secretary of State's office, at least at this point, is not in favor of the changes that Senator Ugenti-Rita is proposing. What was some of the back and forth that Eddie Farnsworth had with some people who came to testify?
Well, yeah, and I should clarify, that was her second PEVL
proposal.
Right,
that was her second PEVL, exactly.
And that one was, in fact, to remove people from the PEVL rolls. So that would mean that if you don't vote for in any primary or general election for a two-year period over two election cycles, you would be purged from that Pebble role. And the testimony in Judiciary yesterday really centered on the convenience versus the inconvenience, I would say, that, you know, some were describing. Chairman Eddie Farnsworth, the Republican from Mesa, repeatedly told those who testified before him that it's not inconvenient to be removed from Pebble. There are, again, a multitude of ways that you can vote. You can go vote in person on the day of the election. You can go to an early voting site. You could also try and sign up for Pebble again, though there is a deadline to do that in order to get the ballot mailed to you. And what testimony after testimony in front of Farnsworth said is, you know, maybe your experience is different than ours. I think that was the core of the argument. There were folks who testified that they had disabilities that made it difficult to vote. There were folks who testified that just because they choose not to participate in an election for a while doesn't mean that they should be kind of left in the dark when the next time they choose to participate, that ballot doesn't get mailed to them.
Ben, not to be too sarcastic, but did I not understand the meaning of what permanent means? I wonder about that.
Yeah, and that's something that Democrats touched on quite a bit in the committee, too. The Republicans' answers was, look, you know, it's our job to set the policy of how our elections are conducted, of how people can vote. And we think of this, the Republicans thought of this as kind of a cleanup measure, because there were a lot of stories shared where people were getting ballots mailed to them for somebody that maybe doesn't live at that apartment or house anymore. And county recorders testified that they do try to clean up the rolls. They do try to keep up with changes of address. But the Republicans argued this is just simply to make sure that we're not mailing out ballots that we don't need to, and we're not mailing ballots to places where people, you know, don't live or just maybe aren't even in the state anymore.
Ben, finally, people are watching Senators Kate Brophy McGee and Heather Carter quite closely because they tend to be sort of in that moderate Republican realm. Is this very much a party line situation right now where we're seeing Republicans more in favor of these Pebble changes and Democrats against?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first bill I discussed about dropping off ballots, we saw earlier this week, that bill is likely dead, though with the caveat that nothing's really dead until the end of session. But both Brophy McGee and Carter told me they're opposed to that particular bill. I have not spoken with either of them yet on this bill to clean up the Pebble rolls, which is a different proposal, and we'll just have to see where they stand on that one as well. But absolutely, these were strictly party line votes in committee hearings, and I expect them to be maybe with the caveat of those two Republicans going forward.
Ben Giles of the Arizona Capital Times. Ben, on a Friday, always good to get Pebble into our vocabulary. Thanks for the time.
Thanks so much.
The University of Arizona men's basketball team has been one of the nation's most dominant programs for decades, but more recently, over the past year or so, it's been connected with controversy, including an FBI investigation related to whether illegal payments were being given to players. That led to the indictment of one of Arizona's former assistant coaches, Book Richardson, and another assistant is now on the firing line, too, though the university says that's not related to the FBI investigation. And as the Wildcats struggle through a rare mediocre season, we wanted to find out what's going on with the program and whether the allegations are affecting its standing. With me for an update is Bruce Pascoe, sports reporter for the Arizona Daily Star. Bruce, what's the overall atmosphere around the program? How are people really feeling about it?
Most fans are pretty supportive of the players, but the excitement level certainly is down, and everybody knows that's a result of, you know, frankly, they're kind of almost being penalized for the investigation already, even though nothing's formally happened to them like that, but it affected their recruiting class. They saved one player, Brandon Williams, from that class who came back, but there were several other really good players that were lined up, and you know that they were, you know, they had a really good chance of landing in the class of 2018. They didn't, and as a result, Sean Miller went into last April with six guys on his roster, scraped together, you know, managed to get a team together. And you know, considering that, I think they're doing about what was expected. This was sort of a, you know, probably a mid-level Pac-12 team. And I think most fans who've been watching it closely knew what to expect. I think if you're a little far removed from it, maybe you're thinking this is really odd because they have been so dominant for so long. But again, this is a very unique situation where not only did all five starters leave, but all those guys who were being lined up to replace him at a pretty high level are also gone, except for one guy. That's what you get, I guess.
Have you picked up on anything based on how people just around the community feel about whether they're a little bit more nervous because they feel like this has been such an important part of the community there? Is there any extra criticism, whether it's people you've talked to, whether it's the sports talk shows, any extra criticism of Sean Miller, or is it sort of like, hey, he's one of our own, we're supporting him?
Well, I think it's mixed there. I think the most often thing I hear is that people are worried about the recruits that they're coming in, because he actually recruited at a very high level in this 2019 class, kids that are in a senior year of high school right now. And I think the feeling is this year's a little down, but if they get these guys in here and everything gets cleared, if it's going to get cleared, then, you know, maybe it kind of goes back on a normal path. But that's a big if. But that seems to be the big concern. And certainly that's been a concern with this latest move to move towards firing one of the assistants who actually had to do with some of these recruitments of these players.
What's the background of that? And is it connected at all to the FBI investigation?
Well, the school says it's not. But I think right now they're reviewing everything that's been going on, you know, both the NCAA and I think internally they are, as far as just seeing what's going on with this program and how they're going to respond to it. And, Mark Phelps actually was suspended for two games at the beginning of the 17-18 season for an NCAA issue. They didn't say what the issue was. When I filed a public records request for it, it didn't say on that. They just said you broke a rule. And, you know, right now they're not offering any specifics right now about what happened, but that's two different things. So my guess is whatever they have, they feel it's worthy, whether it's a cumulative thing or not, because of two different violations, or whether this one was considered a fireable, you know, I don't know at this point, but certainly that's the direction they're moving.
Yeah. Has head coach Sean Miller, is he still getting supported by school administrators, as far as you know, the school president, that kind of thing?
You know, I think they've been pretty supportive in the sense that they're supporting the team and they're saying that they're trying to do the right things and looking out for compliance and this and that. And the statement on Mark Phelps, Dave Peege, the athletic director, said that Sean Miller supported that move. There wasn't a statement from Sean Miller. I think it's, you know, really hard for them to say one way or another right now. They're just, you know, they're trying to be supportive without saying anything they don't know at this point. You know, I don't think everybody knows exactly what's going on here.
Right, because it did seem like when the stuff was going on last season, it did seem like there was firm support, and then I guess that could change if the FBI investigation turns something up, which, as you said, we have no idea what could happen there, too.
Yeah, I mean, it was. I mean, they said some things that were carefully worded as far as, you know, we've asked Coach Miller some pointed questions, and, you know, based on that, we're okay with it, or something along those lines. And then they let Miller have his statement about a year ago after ESPN had reported that he had discussed a pay-per-play thing. And since then, nobody's really said anything about anything. Just sort of been – and when Miller's asked anything, he'll either say no comment or I refer to my previous statement, and that's it.
Is there a feeling that if Arizona doesn't make the NCAA tournament, at this point they probably wouldn't, there any pressure on Sean Miller because of that? Or if there is any pressure on him – is it wholly related to the FBI investigation?
Probably the latter is the case. And I think because he recruited so well, that gives him a little bit of leverage. And that everyone, you know, the thought is, okay, well, if they don't make it this year, they're going to be better next year because of the guys they have coming in. They have two high school All-Americans and two other players who are really good. And Miller's probably, going to add another player or two in the spring. They could be back to a pretty high level. That's sort of the sense I get, is that this is sort of an interim year, so to speak, and the expectation among fans and hope, I'm sure, would be that, you know, they get back to that level next year. And then this year just kind of is what it is, you know.
Bruce Pascoe is a sports reporter for the Arizona Daily Star.
There appears to be concern among a number of groups that the Trump administration might be looking to change a section of the Clean Water Act that gives states say over certain projects. The Western Governors Association, the Council of State Governments, the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, and Western States Water Council are among 10 organizations that have signed on to a letter to an EPA official urging him not to make substantial changes to Section 401 of the Clean Water Act that would diminish states' rights. As one expert describes it, the section is, quote, a vital authority for states to protect their waters from federally permitted activities. Ward Scott is a policy advisor for the Western Governors Association, where he focuses on Western water issues. Our co-host Mark Brody spoke with him via Skype and asked him about his group's concerns with the potential changes that may be coming.
When passing the Clean Water Act initially, Congress deliberately set up a system of cooperative federalism and gave states genuine authority and a meaningful role in implementing the statute. Section 401 often represents the state's only opportunity to review federally permitted activities, and it applies to any federal license for an activity that may result in a discharge into waters of the United States. And so it covers a whole lot of ground and is applied in a wide array of contexts.
And what are the proposed changes here? I mean, is the federal government saying that states would no longer have the authority to say yay or nay to these projects?
Well, what we're seeing are various calls, primarily coming from industry and primarily in response to two decisions that have resulted in the states denying a certification for projects. And these are large-scale energy projects that proponents of those projects have failed to demonstrate to the states that they would not negatively affect water quality. And upon review, the courts have upheld those state decisions. However, we're seeing rhetoric coming from industry that those state decisions were an exercise of states abusing their authority under 401 and hijacking the 401 process to basically further their own political ends. But what we're seeing when we talk to the states is that this section of the Clean Water Act has been very responsibly exercised and implemented by states for the last 45 years, and that the denial of two projects under a reasonable exercise of state authority should not give rise to sweeping changes. And so what we're seeing calls for is a limiting of the scope of state review to review the impacts a project may have on water quality. We're also seeing calls to, limit the timeline that states would have to review these projects. And what would come from this is inevitably an unnecessary increase in the denial of state certifications of projects. And I certainly want to make it clear that the Western governors support the development of infrastructure and streamlined environmental permitting processes. However, it's also the governor's position that these efforts should not come at the expense of state authority to manage, allocate, and protect their water resources. And so we want to make sure that any changes to the 401 program would be informed by the facts on the ground and by state expertise. And we feel that that the state voice has been largely ignored in Washington, D.C. on this issue, and that the states are really the experts of what is happening on the ground as this very important authority is being implemented.
Would these changes have to go back through Congress since it's in the Clean Water Act, which was approved by Congress? Can the EPA just do this on its own?
Well, the EPA is charged as the lead agency in administering the Clean Water Act. And while they've had very little experience in implementing 401, since that is done primarily by the states, they are in charge of, defining the ambiguous terms that are included in the Clean Water Act. So they do have the authority to write rules as to how 401 or other Clean Water Act programs are administered.
You referenced a couple of sort of high-profile instances where states rejected a particular project. By and large, are these federally permitted projects okayed by states, or are a lot of them rejected?
No, what we're finding is that thousands of certifications have been issued under Section 401, and that very, very few have been denied.
What types of projects are typically impacted by this rule that have to get state approval before they can be built?
Well, 401 really covers a wide array of projects, and so it's a very good question. Historically, 401 has been tested in the context of hydropower licensing and relicensing. That's where we see a lot of the traditional court cases that have addressed issues regarding Section 401. However, we're seeing an increase, particularly in the context of natural gas pipelines. And as those have become proposed at a greater rate, we're seeing states review a lot more of those projects. We also see 401 apply to any kind of dredge and fill permits issued by the Corps of Engineers. Any time that there could be a discharge into navigable waters, Section 401 is triggered.
At the risk of asking kind of a political question here, is it surprising to you that a Republican administration would be potentially scaling back states' rights?
I can't speak to any particular party's position on it, but what we're always concerned about is the concept of fair weather federalism, where state authority is typically supported until that state decision does not line up with a particular agenda or with a desired result.
All right. That's Ward Scott, a policy advisor with the Western Governors Association. Ward, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Tony Valdovinos de la Mora wanted to be in the military, but instead ended up in politics, and now he is the subject of a new musical. Valdovinos came to the U.S. when he was 2. The now 28-year-old owns a company that does get out the vote work in Arizona. He's also a DACA recipient. The musical, based on his life, Americano, is in the development stage. Phoenix Theater will workshop the show tonight and tomorrow. That's basically a reading of the production. Our co-host Mark Brody recently sat down with him to talk about his life and seeing it on stage.
I want to go back to your high school years, specifically your senior year in high school, where you sort of had it sounds like you really sort of had a plan for what you wanted to do, and that plan kind of quickly got changed and derailed somewhat, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And, that plan for me was destiny. You know, I wanted to be in the Marine Corps since I was in sixth grade. That's when 9/11 had happened. But that is what I wanted to do, and I remember very clearly the emotions behind it, the fear, the excitement, the duty, and most of all, it was the honor that I felt was the most important for me to bring to the family.
How did it come to pass that you found out that that was not really an option for you?
I was with a recruiter at Camelback High School, I was with him. I was going to the recruiting office to take the test, and he was asking me questions about where I was from, and told him I was from Mexico, and he very quickly asked me if I had my documents in order, and I wasn't sure how to answer that question because it was very taboo in our family and in our culture, and so I wasn't sure how to answer that, and he looked at me straight in the eye and told me to get out of the car, that I was wasting his time and that I was wasting my time. And at that moment, it just truly understood something significant had just happened in my life. And I went home and I demanded an answer. I wanted to understand. I was about to leave high school while everybody was going to college. And it was the truth came out. And we had a very family conversation. And it was very daunting for me and very heavy to understand that I practically was invisible.
At what point did you realize that maybe this DACA program, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, that might be an option for you to maybe go to school or be able to work in the state?
I think, and I'll tell you the absolute truth, when I got involved, civically engaged, we didn't know much about DACA. We knew what the DREAM Act was. And DACA showed up through a lot of advocacy and pressure on the Obama administration. And the day that it actually came to light, it was the first day I heard about it. But it was a very emotional day because we all huddled up and watched CNN unroll this program. And there was a lot of tears because it symbolized safety.
It's interesting that to you, DACA meant safety, because at the time, we kept hearing stories about people maybe being a little apprehensive about signing up for it, not wanting to give the government all their personal information. Sounds like that wasn't necessarily a concern for you.
Absolutely not. That was one of the most that happened very fiercely throughout the community. There was a significant amount of Dreamers that did not sign up for the DACA program. I know a lot of people still that did not sign up for the program. It's unbelievable not to sign up for the program. And we raised a lot of money over the years to help students afford the application because, you know, the idea of having temporary relief was incredible because it gave the opportunity to still figure out the issue. And we understood that we had to do a lot more advocacy work to get more people out to vote so we can have the correct representation.
All right, so I've got to ask you about this musical. That's kind of crazy, right?
Yeah,
that somebody's making
a
musical about your life?
Mm-hmm. It's an incredible opportunity, but absolutely, it is very crazy for me, right? It's and I think that this is the very first time that there's an opportunity to tell my singular story in a much broader picture. There's been other stories of dreamers who have accomplished other things and have done other work, but I think for me, it's a great opportunity to be able to tell this story of hardship, triumph, and hardship. But most importantly for me, it was all based on what I loved and believed so much about in the Marine Corps, which is honor, courage, and commitment. And having the courage and the commitment to move forward through these adversities and still believe in what we believed in when we first started, you know, when we first wanted to go to school, when I first wanted to join the Marine Corps.
Was your family on board with this from the beginning? Did you have to convince them that it was okay for your story to be up on stage for everybody and anybody to see?
Look, absolutely not. You know, my mom, from the beginning, you know, from when I first got involved in a political campaign, started doing interviews, started being very vocal out there, there was a lot of fear, but we have to move forward. And people do not understand what's happening unless it is brought to light. And so there was a lot of responsibility for us to go out there and advocate for this issue, but a lot of issues also within the communities. You know, when it comes to the play and the balance of where I came from and here we are, fast forward, now there's a play, we're still in that same fight.
What do you think it's going to be like for you to be sitting in a theater and seeing a guy up on stage as you telling your life story?
You know, I did a little, I watched one reading. There was two, but I could only go to the first one. It was really tough because it was surreal and it was very, I can't even imagine to tell you what it's like to, so, you know, see a lot of these amazing actors unfold your actual life situations. You know, there's a scene where there was a fight in high school that I had that was a major part of my high school time that really changed a lot for me. And so, you know, to see that, it was just really fascinating to just see some of the downfalls, to see some of the uplifts. That was emotional. But I think it's important for me to be able to tell that story on a much broader scale. There's more context to me as a human, as a person, versus just an undocumented entrepreneur who has done a lot of work in politics. And so I think that just gives you a better picture of what it really is to just be a person in the United States dreaming.
That was Tony Valdovinos de la Mora speaking with our co-host Mark Brody. The musical is based on his life and it's called Americano. It's being workshopped tonight and tomorrow night at Phoenix Theater.
Muhammad Ali was one of the most famous people in the world. He was renowned for his boxing prowess and many legendary fights, but it was his charismatic speaking and boastful rhymes that helped him connect with all ages and backgrounds. Before he converted to Islam, though, Muhammad Ali was young Cassius Clay, growing up in the 1950s in Louisville, Kentucky, in segregation. Long after his boxing career had ended, Ali spent a lot of time here in the Valley as part of his treatment for Parkinson's disease. And now the Phoenix-based Black Theater Troupe and Child's Play have teamed up to bring Ali's early life and first forays into boxing to the stage in the production of And In This Corner, Cassius Clay. With me to talk about it are Raphael Hamilton, who plays the young Clay, and the play's director, Michael Jerome Johnson. Raphael, was it more exciting or more daunting to play such a famous person who generates such strong opinions, even though you're playing him in his very early years?
It's a little bit of both. just because people have their own memories and experiences, whether it's in person or what he's contributed to them just from what he's done. So trying to find that fine line of telling the story of Cassius as well as giving them pieces of Muhammad Ali. So that's been the challenge, but this guy right here, Michael, yeah, has been really great at directing me in the right way and steering me away from certain things when I go too far of trying to do one thing versus telling the actual story.
So. Did you find yourself at all, not mimicking, I don't mean that, but because there are so many videos of Ali giving these amazing interviews, did you ever find yourself getting into that? And then I'll ask Michael, you know, what he had to do about that.
Yes, a lot. Michael's note for me consistently has been with the poetry, don't try to mimic it, just tell the story. Right. So with that, it's been taking me away from not trying to imitate him, but just find the spirit of Muhammad Ali and let that carry over into the character itself.
So it was hard to not let him imitate him, but just to be him.
Okay.
And that's a different thing, because if you could be him, then you can actually see him on the stage. And that's what I was looking for.
So when you were casting, mm-hmm, how did you go about deciding whether, because, you know, we always talk about, does the person look like the person? Can the person possibly move like the person? This is obviously a physical play to some extent, too. How does that go into it?
Well, since I was also choreographing the fights, I was not only looking for somebody who could be him, but could they fight, and could I teach them how to fight? So part of my audition was not only having them read scenes, but also I actually did an impromptu class on boxing to see if he can do it.
Yeah.
And yeah, he convinced me.
So what's the age range we're covering here?
12 to 18.
Wow, okay.
And I'm also narrating as, we would say, probably Muhammad Ali is narrating the story of his life. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. It says narrator Cassius, but I said Muhammad Ali. And I always think about the fact that in 1996 when he lit the torch, and I remember fussing because I was, you know, the torch is going all around the country, right? Okay. And you get into the Olympics and everybody's running around and this, that, and the other. I said, okay, where's Ali? Excuse me. Where's Ali? And I think it was Janet Evans, or I think running up and said, okay, she's going to light. Where is it? And he's there to take the torch and light it. I said, yes, yes. And then I thought about it. Duh, Johnson, of course he's going to light it.
Yeah. It's in Atlanta.
And it's in Atlanta, right. But for me, that was the pinnacle of his career, even though his career had been over. When I was offered the role, offered the chance to direct this, that kept going on in my mind, and I kept thinking, and knowing that he couldn't talk that much back then because of Parkinson's, mm-hmm, I said, but if he could, this is the man who would be telling this story in this play. So that's what I think of when I think
that's
of him.
Great. What did you guys learn? What did you learn about what he was like as a young man? Was he any humbler as a younger man? How did that work?
That's what I think I like the most about it, is because I'm able to show the part of him that people aren't that familiar with. We know Muhammad Ali, but we don't know how he becomes this amazing, iconic person. He was human just like us. He had struggles and fears just like us as well, and he had to deal with some situations that weren't easy also. So that part was actually, I think that's what made it more comfortable, because I don't have to be this iconic figure per se. Mm-hmm. I'm actually able to be the human side of who he was that we are as well, you know, outside of the fame, the boxing, the humanitarian, the civil rights leader. I get to be the human, the person, how he become, how he struggled, he fought. He had his own issues that he had to deal with and overcome. So, yeah.
I'm struck by the fact that this, when we think about Muhammad Ali now, he's praised to the hilt. And yet if we look back in American history, when he wouldn't go to the Vietnam War,
mm-hmm,
I mean, he was a piece of garbage, I'm sure, to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And then now we can look back at him and say, what an admirable figure, what an interesting man, so fascinating. What does that tell you about our society? How is he like the epitome of that?
I always think about the fact that he was stripped of his title and he was put in prison for not going to Vietnam because of his religious beliefs. And he was a black man. Mm-hmm. And he was a controversial black man, mm-hmm, who backed it up by his skills and his personality and everything like that, and still prevailed. Mm-hmm. Okay? The way I look at it, we needed Muhammad Ali at that point in the history of this country in order for this country to take a step forward, mm-hmm, and a gigantic leap forward. As big as somebody walking on the moon, he was the one that we had to have in order for society to change.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that's how important he is to me. Yeah.
And me too. It's like, though I wasn't born in that era, obviously, but my grandparents, my great-grandparents, the stories, and listening to them and understanding like how black people and black men in general were viewed during that time, he took a stance when leaders were being literally killed. So for him to have that type of courage to stand up for his beliefs, to stand up for his blackness, and not discount any other cultures or races, but to just affirm the power of who we are as people. And he took that risk during, like I said, when you could have been literally killed. That speaks a lot about who he was. And like Mike said, his title was stripped, his way of living was stripped, and yet he never wavered from his beliefs and from what his core values were. For me, it's important to share this because my cousin Alfred Wright was the young man who was tied and dragged behind the truck in Jasper, Texas, years ago. Yeah. So we had this moment in rehearsals before we even got to the actual show itself. In our rehearsals, we had this conversation about different things that have impacted our lives and how they affect us. And that helped me just to connect to the importance of this story, just to understand that even, what was 2010 or 11, if I'm not mistaken, that someone that I was personally close to experienced some of the same torture that Emmett Till experienced in the 60s or 50s. Mm-hmm. So to have that connection and that experience personally, love you, Alfie, it's humbling to play this part, and it's important for me to share this story with people, young people, older people, black, white, Hispanic, whatever color culture, because we still have some growth and maturing to do as a people, as a culture of people.
Raphael Hamilton plays Cassius Clay, and Michael Johnson is the director of the play, and in this corner, Cassius Clay, which runs through March 3rd. It's co-produced with Child's Play. It's going to be at the Helen K. Mason Performing Arts Center as part of Black Theater Troupe. Guys, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on 91.5 KJZZ in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein with Lauren Gilger. Now it's time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
In the past, most of the people in this room voted for a wall, but the proper wall never got built. I will get it built.
Time and time again, there were references to things of the past, and if we're going to be able to work together, which we need to for the American people, we have to look to the future.
You know, as a woman member of Congress, there is a lot of things that we can work together in a bipartisan fashion to help not only women, but the entire country.
We're watching the House Ethics Committee very closely. We expect action. We believe that David Stringer has revealed himself to be unfit to serve in the Arizona legislature, and we think it should be removed.
The system is called vote by mail. We send it to you, you send it back. It's a popular system, I use it myself, but you need to mail it back. I can't think of anything more convenient than mailing back your ballot once you've received it.
And with us to talk about President Trump's State of the Union address, along with some news from the legislature and more, our Marcus Dell'Artino, partner at First Strategic, and former Tempe Mayor Neil Giuliano, now CEO at Greater Phoenix Leadership. Guys, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So, Marcus, yes, President sir. Trump, State of the Union, was he reaching out or was he playing the same game?
I think he was reaching out. I mean, his tone was definitely different than we've heard in the past. And frankly, you know, I've said this privately, and so I'll go out on a limb. I think it was one of his best speeches of probably his lifetime, frankly. Now, he's not the best speech giver. Let's get that out. But I think I think it was one of his best performances, no doubt. I think he tried to strike some bipartisanship. I think there were some signs of it. You know, Kyrsten Sinema stood up at a certain part of that speech. Now, one of her Democratic members rumored to tell her to sit down. I think he probably struck the right chord, and he certainly struck the right chord for the Republicans. I think they had enough red meat during that speech to coalesce around him.
Well, and that was all. This is Neil. That was all that mattered for him. Let's be honest. That was a speech that played mostly to his base. I appreciated some of the outreach. The tone was nice. You know, a couple of times I woke up during the speech and I was just kind of curious what he was talking about right then. I heard him talking about HIV/AIDS. This is the guy who fired the entire AIDS Council, has not hired a White House Office of National AIDS Policy director. But it was curious. It was interesting.
Were those people really doing anything anyway?
Yes.
Are you okay? No,
yes. Is this small G government versus big G government?
Yeah.
But
yes,
Neil, briefly. No. So was the bipartisanship believable at any level, whether it's for infrastructure or anything else?
I think, yeah, there are areas in which I think there will be bipartisan work moving forward, whether it moves all the way forward to an actual bill that can be advanced. Certainly Arizona would benefit tremendously if there's an infrastructure bill. I think that's really important. I hope they can make that happen.
You and me both.
But when it came to the border wall then, since we're a border state, let's pivot there. And since this is the focus of what may be another shutdown next week, do you see any bipartisanship there? Do you see Trump kind of holding this line?
I think we will know the bipartisanship is working right now. The sides are talking. I know the same reports everyone else is hearing, that it looks like they're getting close to having a deal. Whether the president accepts the deal or not is the other thing. You know, right. You have a challenge when you go out and you consult and you put this out to your legislators on both sides of the aisle. You have to be willing to accept what they come back to you with. And I'm not sure the president will accept what comes back to him. That's a big unknown.
Yeah, I'm not as optimistic, I think, as everybody else is, and maybe it's my cynical nature on special interests or going to find a reason to blow up the deal because that's how they make their money. And so so I've got a funny feeling that it may not pan out. But, you know, the irony is, of course, everybody knows what the solution is. We've known about it for 15 years, right? Okay, build the wall, but do comprehensive immigration reform at the same time, including DACA. But it's never going to happen because it doesn't work to the advantage of each individual party or the special interests.
So how much worse do the parties look, or maybe they don't, at this point? Like if Mitch McConnell thinks he has a deal with Chuck Schumer or someone else, and then they don't really know the wild card once they go to the White House, how disconcerting, how frustrating can that be?
Epically frustrating.
Especially for the folks in government at this time. But I think what we have to remember is that we're in the phase after the midterms, and while people are already announcing for 2020 and so forth, for most of America, we're in the period where not many people are really paying attention. And you got to remember that. We pay attention. It's what we do. Obviously, the members of Congress and so forth, there's groups that pay attention. But most of America, not so much.
Do you think the shutdown cut through that, though, because it was so long? And
for a period of time.
Right.
Certainly for a period of time, it did.
So let's talk about the bipartisanship here, though. I want to, as you look at this, so much of what is interesting about the story around this is that it's so about the political win, right? Like the Democrats are not going to give Trump a political win on this, and Trump is not going to accept anything but being able to say he won on the wall. Do you think this is what this is actually about, or do you think when those bipartisan debates are going on right now, they're going to come up with something more bipartisan, more comprehensive in terms of immigration reform?
Well, I think if there's any movement at all from the newly empowered Democrats in the House, they will want to get something done. Will it go as far as their Republican colleagues want or not is the big question, and we just don't know yet. I'm optimistic. I'm kind of optimistic that something will come forward. I'm not optimistic that it will go all the way because I think the president is not going to be happy with the compromise that the Republicans have made on their behalf, on his behalf.
Now, gentlemen, someone who has been very critical of President Trump just made an announcement on another media outlet. We won't mention what that is. His name is Grant Woods. And after all the clamor, after the Senator McCain memorial service and getting back into the public eye, Marcus, Neil, I think you guys both called this, Grant Woods, not a Senate candidate in 2020. Marcus, let's talk about that a little bit.
Shocker. I don't think Grant had a path to victory, and I think that's pretty clear. And I should say I consider Grant a friend. I think he's a good person. But listen, I'm not too sure how you get through a Democratic primary after endorsing Jan Brewer. And there's a series of other things from, you know, whether you go to his radio show, whether you go to his political statements. You know, he's evolved certainly into the Democratic Party, but there is that past there, and working through that Democrat primary would have been difficult is an understatement.
Well, there's difficulty, Neil, but there's also the feeling of, was he going to be some sort of alternative? Was he someone that would have tried to be a problem solver and less partisan?
Oh, I think without a doubt, Grant Woods would have been a rather stellar and very strong senator representing Arizonans' core, what Arizona is all about. He has that running through his blood. Marcus is right in terms of a path to victory. But I think more than that, and I haven't spoken with him since the announcement just a few minutes ago, obviously, but what we see now, the extremes of both parties, which are the bases, which you really need to begin and move a campaign forward, they want you to agree with them. They want you to be loud. They want you to be obnoxious on their behalf. And for the most part, if you're not, they don't have much time for you. And that's not Grant Woods. Grant Woods, in my view, and he's been a friend of mine for 30-some years, he is, excuse the word, elder, but, you know, he's an elder statesman at this point. He has traversed many different issues over in our state for many, many years. And I think getting down and dirty and realizing what you have to do to get elected to the U.S. Senate just at this point wasn't going to be what he wanted to do.
I would add to this, though. I'm not too sure his path to victory wouldn't have been running as an independent. Hmm. The issue with that, of course, is it's twice as much work.
Twice as much money.
Correct. And maybe twice is a little low. Maybe it's four times as much work. And remember, it's not like he really needs another job. He's doing pretty well in his private sector life.
Here's the thing, and not to leave Lauren out of this, because she doesn't fit into this position, which is good, Lauren. a male going through a midlife crisis, which I can certainly relate to.
Is
there a feeling that he just counted the, let's say I can go to Italy and teach classes for 6 weeks, I can do an album, I can write a play, I can sit in a nice estate and not worry about those things. Ultimately, do you have to want to get in the dirt and fight to do this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, for him, I think it'd be, look, I won't have as much time to play basketball. And he's right. You just won't. And you've got to be constantly raising money, and you got to be in the muck of it.
It is a little too bad, though, because he would have been a phenomenal senator for representing Arizona, political issues aside and so forth. He's just a decent, wonderful man who would have represented Arizona really well. Now you have to look at, okay, what's left in that Democratic primary? Is it Ruben Gallego? Is it Mark Kelly? Does Martha McSally end up having a challenger in her party? Still a lot of unknowns as we move forward on this one.
You want to get into the unknowns at this point? Any predictions who we might see on the Democratic side first?
I think Mark Kelly will jump into it for sure. I think Congressman Gallego is considering it and wants to get into it. But, you know, look, the lesson was learned this last time. Republicans had a very ugly, messy primary, and it didn't work so well for the candidate trying to go from August to November. You flip that for 2020, will the Democrats do the same thing or not, or will they be a little smarter than the Republicans were last time? All to be determined.
Well, doesn't Ruben Gallego fit what Neil was talking about, Marcus, the idea that the parties want someone who's loud? Gallego's been very loud about President Trump, very critical. And Mark Kelly will have that, the Gabby Giffords connection, the fact that he is an American hero, but also the NRA will certainly aim their money at him too.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, I think that's an interesting primary. I mean, Gallego versus Mark Kelly. But, you know, and the storyline with Mark Kelly is somewhat entertaining, right? Because we've heard that Martha McSally's a pilot. I don't know if you guys heard that. I've heard that. And he's going to say, well, I'm a pilot too, but I'm also an astronaut. So it's almost like a one-upsmanship kind of game. Yeah.
But then put fighter in with pilot. And maybe that's up a little.
Stop the whole pilot thing to death.
Well, hopefully Elon Musk doesn't get into it. He sent convertibles into space. So
But I think Ruben's done a great job on the left side, kind of coalescing the progressive side of the party.
And absolutely.
So I think that you're going to have a battle from sort of the middle of the party, a Democratic Party, if there is a middle left, and the progressive side.
Well, guys, before the break, finally on this then. Does Ruben Gallego, does Mark Kelly, does Felicia Rodellini, do any of them breathe a sigh of relief that Grant Woods isn't running?
I think it clears up. It just makes the decision-making easier for others. It clears up potential money for others. Look, it's math, money, and message. It clears up the message a little bit. Nobody has to sort of stay in the middle without Grant in the race in a primary because Grant would have been in the middle. I think there'll be some interesting calculations as a result of Grant not being in the race.
Yeah, if you're running a campaign, you want to get rid of your unknowns, right? And so you get rid of your unknown by Grant getting out of the race. And to Neil's point, it brings, you know, more money and more focus and more messaging and a time advantage to your candidate who's a Democrat coming out of that primary.
That's Marcus Dellartino. Also here is Neil Giuliano in Phoenix with Lauren Gilger. I'm Steve Goldstein. This is the Friday News Cap, which continues after this. Good morning. This is the Friday Newscap on 91.5 KJZZ in Phoenix with Lauren Gilger. I'm Steve Goldstein. Our guests today are Marcus Dell'Artino, partner at First Strategic, and former Tempe Mayor Neil Giuliano, now CEO at Greater Phoenix Leadership. So, Neil, let's talk about what's going on at the legislature, the attempt to clean up PEVL, which was fun to say a couple of times earlier this morning, the permanent early voting list, and also just the idea of voting by mail, changing that. Senator Michelle Ujanti-Rita is pushing for some changes. Some folks didn't react real well to it, but there is still a lot of Republican support. What do you make of it?
Well, I still go back. I'm curious as to what the constituency was for this proposed legislation. I don't think any of it is going to get anywhere. It seems pretty obvious at this point. There's at least some Republicans who are not going to be supportive. But look, this is a time in our culture and in our politics. We should be doing everything we can to encourage and make it easier for people to participate in our democracy. These voter suppression ideas that are out there that come from all over the place, and we see them all over the country, are not the way to govern. And so, of course, it takes a while for those votes that are dropped off to be counted. It's the same as it's always been. The difference this time is we had some really close elections, so we were all still paying attention. Most of the time, we've forgotten about the election 2 days later, and we're not waiting to see what those other 30,000 votes, how those people voted, because it didn't matter. The election was really already won. So that's really the only distinction, and these aren't going anywhere. Mm. What do you think, Marcus? I'm just watching you here.
No, I don't think the bills have a chance. Everybody sort of forgets that although the Republicans have a two-seat advantage in the Senate, there's only a one-seat advantage in the House, and much more delicate. And I don't think that this bill ultimately would have had the votes to pass. But there is a danger here that I think gets often overlooked here, and is if you flirt too much with election law, Department of Justice likes to swoop in and start monitoring your elections. We in Arizona just got dismissed from that oversight that had been going on for as long as I can remember. It's been quite some time. And so we just got, under the Obama administration, ironically, but released from that oversight. If we go down this path, we will be back under Department of Justice oversight, and I will tell you that that is just not somewhere we want to be.
Right.
And as you talk about the balance in the Senate, so much of this is about two senators, right? Those middle-of-the-road Republicans, Kate Brophy McGee and Heather Carter. Let's talk a little bit about their role and sort of the ways in which, if they go one way or the other, they're controlling a lot of this debate. What do you make of this, Neil?
Oh, I think they have a wonderful opportunity for leadership to really be the conscience, to be the arbiters, to be the thought leaders on a lot of these divisive issues that otherwise might go to one extreme or another. It's a role that both of them are very capable of performing. And as the session is starting out, they're unfortunately having to play that role quickly. And I'm sure on other issues they will as well.
Yeah, and both of them represent more moderate districts.
Sure.
And so that is playing into the overall Senate dynamics.
Yeah. Bigger picture on this, too, playing off what Lauren just said, I wonder if we're going to look for this kind of thing. Are we more likely, I guess it depends on the issue, Marcus, do you think we're more likely to see a couple of D's sort of cement Republicans on certain issues, or more likely to see Republicans end up moving to Democrats? I'm sort of thinking more in terms of budget, because we saw so much when it came to Red for Ed, K-12 funding, that kind of thing.
You know,
it's probably too early to tell, but I'm curious, too.
It's an interesting dynamic occurring. You know, certainly the Democrats are elated with Governor Ducey right now over tax conformity. Mm-hmm. And I know for a fact that the governor's reached out to a lot of Democrats on budget issues. So there is a dynamic there at play. But at the end of the day, I think it comes down to certain issues. You know, where they're going to be built, both of them are going to be building coalitions that coalesce around the issue, not so much around party or personalities.
And this is good for the process. People actually have to talk to each other. And you have to engage with people of the other party who might have a slightly or somewhat more than slightly different view on things. That is, I think, what we should be wanting and expecting from our legislators. So I'm happy to see it happen.
How different is that than it has been in the past? I mean, we've talked a lot about the closer split in the House and how it's a little bit closer in the Senate now. But, I mean, is this really making a much bigger impact than even we thought it might?
Well, I can tell you there have been past sessions when Democrats would go the entire session without being consulted by the majority, you know, just because that's you don't have to consult with the minority party. And so I think that's a positive that there's actually conversations taking place.
And I also think that it's part of the personality of the leadership of both those chambers right now. Yeah. Rusty Bowers and Karen Fan, both are very patient people, thoughtful on policy and personalities. And Bowers has made it quite clear that, you know, he wants to – the institution comes first. Mm-hmm. And so he's going to sort of reach out across the aisle. And that's just who Rusty's entire career, I think, has been.
So how much patience are we going to see with Representative David Stringer? Are we going to see as bigger issues take hold? Are we going to hear less and less about them? We're going to let this ethics investigation play out. Marcus, how much would Republicans love to see David Stringer commit a little harry-carry and just quit, and then they could put another conservative Republican in there?
Well, that's certainly the preferred solution, I think, for the Republicans, because to my point, the margins, it's a one-seat margin. So, causes them quite a headache up there. Even a recall election causes them a headache. Let's just say, for argument's sake, it's a very strong Republican district. People need to know that. But in a recall election, you have 10 Republicans running, one Democrat. That could present quite a problem. The ethics investigation, as I understand, is going to be somewhat quick. I think we're expecting something shortly here. I contend that this really comes down to the State Bar of Arizona, and I'm sure they'd be thrilled to hear me say that. But if they conclude their investigation that somehow during his application that he wasn't truthful on that, then I think he's got a real problem. If he was truthful on that, it's an interesting case. You need to remember this goes back to 83. There are accusations. I'm not too sure, but we're not ever going to be able to know the totality of what those are. Didn't happen in the state of Arizona. Didn't happen when he was a legislator. So we are going to start walking this very odd line in Arizona. What is enough to throw a member out? It's going to be a gut wrencher, I will tell you.
Well, because Neil, as uncomfortable as it is to have someone who's blatantly seems like a racist, First Amendment allows him to say that. Voters put him back in. As Marcus is talking about these other things in Maryland, take it to a much higher level.
I think the voices in his district will ultimately decide this. Looking, the gentleman's been elected a couple of times from up there. He's well known in that part of the state, and it's those voices from that are close to him and within that his constituency, particularly Republican constituency within his district, are the ones that will address this most forthright.
Mm-hmm. As we wrap up, David Stringer survives the session or no?
Oh, God, that is such a tough one. I don't – I go back and forth on that one. I really do. I think that at some point, the body gets exhausted with dealing with the problem, right? And so I tell – you know, if you see the same elected official on TV every day, you get exhausted with seeing that, and that plays into voters' habits too. So I'm just not too sure – if he does survive – the session, ultimately, I think the voters, where I contend this issue belongs. The issue belongs back with his voters, not in a body of 60 of his colleagues. It belongs with the people who elected him. Therefore, they should be doing a recall election.
Yeah, I would add to that, depending upon the outcome of the investigations, his peers will have the choice of really two paths. They can sort of go back to the norm. I don't think that's going to happen. Or they can isolate and ignore, which is, I think, what will happen. And then his district will deal with it.
Neil Giuliano of Greater Phoenix Leadership, Marcus Dellartino of First Strategic. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Medicare is a government program that provides health care coverage to people 65 years and older. It doesn't cover pediatrics or maternity care. Seniors typically don't need those. So what is meant when we hear Medicare for all? Most politicians don't actually mean expanding Medicare to everyone, no matter their age. What they mean typically is simply expanding access to government-sponsored health care. But what does that look like exactly? Sarah Cliff, health policy journalist for Vox, spent a month looking at the different Medicare for all overall plans. She split the proposals into two groups briefly. One would end private insurance altogether. Every one of us would move to public insurance plans. The other would be less of a transition. People could buy into public programs if they wanted. Okay, but again, what does that mean? What would be covered? Who would benefit? As our partner Amy Walter, today's host with The Takeaway, found, none of it is straightforward. Her conversation begins as she asked Cliff one of the most pressing questions. How much do these programs cost?
So that's a place where I think Democrats still need to do a lot more analysis and work. It would require a decent amount of tax revenue. The Congressional Budget Office, our nonpartisan scorekeeper here in Washington, hasn't scored it yet. But there are a few different scores floating around that suggest, this would require raising a lot of revenue. That being said, all of us would stop paying premiums for health insurance. So while it would require a lot more spending on the part of the government, we would also no longer be spending on private insurance. A lot of the buy-in plans I mentioned, they don't expect to be that expensive because they essentially expect, people who decided to buy into the public plan would pay premiums to get into the public plan, just like we pay premiums to our private plan. So that's another way that these two types of plans differ in terms of whether they require raising a lot of tax revenue or whether they expect new enrollees to essentially pay their way into the program.
But is the theory behind all of these that healthcare is too expensive and this is a way to rein in healthcare costs? Or is this about we need to make sure everybody's covered and hopefully one benefit will be that costs come down because of the way that the government can play such a big role in containing the cost, but that's not our top priority.
It's a combination of both of those right now, and I think different legislators have different motivations in what they're doing. I think there's pretty widespread recognition among Democrats right now that the Affordable Care Act did not go as far as they would like, that if they could do it again, they would have made the deductible smaller, they would have made it more affordable health care. And so when I look at these attempts to expand public coverage, they seem like a desire to remedy that. And I think there's a split right now between the Sanders camp and the Medicare for All camp, which says that we need the government to run the entire system. We need the government to regulate prices. That is how we're going to get to affordable health care. And the other plans that say, there's still a role for private insurance, that if we have a government player in the mix that's going to help bring down prices via competition, that's a big split, in the party right now that I don't think they've really settled. And I think when I talk to folks on the Hill, when I talk to 2020 campaigns, they see the next 2 years leading up to the election as a time when this policy debate is going to play out. The Affordable Care Act was our compromise option. It was the thing we hoped to get Republican support for, so we put in these private marketplaces. If we're never going to get the Republicans to support healthcare ideas, we should just go for the thing we actually want. And the thing we actually want is a more single-payer Canadian or European-style system. So I think there was a bit of an awakening in the Democratic Party over the past few years where they realized Republicans are never going to get on board with the Affordable Care Act. So why not go for a system that isn't an attempt at compromise, that looks a lot more like other industrialized nations?
Wasn't there a debate during the 2009-2010 Obamacare time over whether to include a public option, right? Whether to basically have a Medicare buy-in. And why was that unsuccessful then? And why would it be more successful now?
So this was a robust part of the debate. It was something that the House really wanted and pushed for, was a public government-run option that could compete on the private marketplaces and hopefully drive down prices, for all Americans. And it essentially had to be lost as the bill got a little more centrist through its different iterations, through its path through the Senate. And you just couldn't get enough support for the buy-in option in the Senate. So it was eventually dropped, as they moved towards finding something that could get 60 senators on board. Would it be more possible right now? One of the things I wonder about, and I don't really know, is how committed Democrats feel like they are to having industry buy-in. The Obama administration felt like it was crucial to get doctors and drug makers and insurers on board with the healthcare plan. They had seen how big healthcare interests could sink a healthcare reform package with Clinton Care back in the 90s. So they felt like if we're going to get anywhere, we need to have all these players on board. I don't know if Democrats feel that way or not. Republicans got awfully close to repealing the Affordable Care Act, despite, most of the health industry lining up against them. And so I don't know if Democrats are taking a lesson from that, saying, you know, maybe we don't need these allies, because what you're going to see if they do pursue a public option, if they pursue Medicare for all, the insurance industry is not going to be thrilled at that, and they will near certainly oppose those efforts. So I think that's an open question of how do Democrats maneuver that particular space.
You know, not only did they learn some lessons perhaps from the repeal fight, but also the party has taken a much harder line, the Democratic Party harder line on sort of corporatist influences within the party, showing your allegiance and alliance with a bill that the industry likes is considered now a liability rather than something that is, you know, good policy.
Yeah, that's totally right. I think it's an interesting question of, you know, the insurance industry, the drug industry in particular, has a lot of money. They do a lot of lobbying. And I don't know how those two forces run into each other at this exact moment. If Democrats feel like we can overcome the insurance industry, most people aren't big fans of the insurance industry, we can weather their advertising against us, or if there still is that hesitation, thinking that we can't weather those sorts of attacks and the amount of money they would spend, you know, campaigning against a bill like this one.
I'm old enough to remember the fight over healthcare in the 90s, where the health insurance industry was very influential mm-hmm. with these so-called Harry and Louise ads.
But this was covered under our old plan.
Yeah, that was a good one, wasn't it?
Where they're raising questions about the health care plan that Democrats were then pushing through, saying, you're going to lose your health care. This is going to be terrible. Government's going to take it over.
Having choices we don't like is no choice at all.
Yeah, they choose.
We lose.
I'm wondering if that may be a factor as well, is there are very few Democrats in Congress right now who were around in the 90s.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I think, you know, when I followed the Obamacare debate, those Harry and Louise ads would come up all the time. And they seem to like there's a little bit of PTSD in like the health policy right. liberal circles around having those kind of ads. And then, you know, you have folks like newcomers like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who, you know, might say, screw it, I'm not scared of the insurance industry. Like, I am ready to give this another try. But I think you're right. We're talking, you know, at this point of, you know, 20 years passing since those ads ran, maybe they'll be a little bit less salient than they were during the Affordable Care Act debate.
Do you think there is ultimately going to be some sort of consensus around what a final Medicare for All bill would look like? Or do you think that ultimately there will just be these multiple bills floating around and candidates and campaigns are going to have to take sides?
So I don't think we'll have a consensus by the end of this election. What I'd expect is to see candidates kind of carving out their own niche. And then I think if, you know, a Democrat does win the White House in 2020, one of the things that's really crucial is whether they decide to make healthcare a priority, you know, not just what their policy is, but whether they decide, okay, this is the thing that I'm going to make a really big push for. So I think we end 2020 with a better understanding of how these plans work, how much they would cost, who would gain insurance. I don't think we end the election with a clear consensus of, among Democrats of, okay, this is the plan that we're all lining up behind.
Sarah Cliff, thank you so much for coming and helping to explain all of this.
Thank you for having me.
And that's Amy Walter at our partner, The Takeaway. And on this Friday, you're listening to the show on KJZZ.
Bill Konigsberg was a sports writer for AP and ESPN for most of his career, and he is gay. That last fact shouldn't be relevant to the first, but he found out it really was. More than a decade ago, he wrote about this experience, being out in the world of sports, and his efforts won him a coveted Lambda Literary Award. Now the Gilbert resident has turned his talents to fiction, writing for an audience of young adults struggling with their own understanding of being LGBTQ. His first book focused on a teen football player who has to reveal his sexuality to his teammates. Could he still be one of the guys and be honest about who he is? These are the subjects Konigsberg regularly takes on in his work, and as the genre around it has continued to change. We started our conversation about his time in the sports world and how he approached being out in this world.
So here's the thing. I came out in high school, and this is many, many years ago, so that's a little bit odd, in the 1980s. I knew I was gay and I came out. However, I never quite figured out how to be all the parts of myself, and I was a big sports fan. So all of my life led to me working at ESPN, but I couldn't reconcile how to be openly gay because ESPN was like working at a frat house.
I'm sure.
It was just nuts. And I really liked it, but I also felt like there was a part of me missing. So what happened one day about 3 years into my employment is there was a story about the potential of an openly gay baseball player. And all of the sports writers were saying this and that and talking about could it happen. And I realized that I was there and I wasn't using my voice.
Yeah.
So very, very quickly, I wrote an essay in about 10 minutes, maybe five. It was called Sports World, Still a Struggle for Gays. And I brought it into my editor's office and I put it on his desk. I sat down. I watched him read it. He didn't know I was gay. He looked up. He said, I think we should put it on the front page of ESPN.com.
Wow.
So
what year was this?
This was 2001.
Wow, okay.
So a long, long time ago. And that's how I became an openly gay man in sports. and it's just kind of, now it's sort of a funny story, but I wound up becoming somebody who would speak on that topic.
Kind of by default almost. Like you didn't mean for this or forge that path, like you wanted to speak out. It just sort of felt like something you needed to do.
It just happened.
But you've said that, you know, being gay in the sports world should not be a big deal. You said that in that essay. I mean, is it still, you think?
You know, it is still, but it's much less so. And I think that's the case throughout all of our society. 2001 was Will and Grace. And if you think about Will and Grace compared to where we are now, where almost every television show seems to have a gay character, that's, I don't know if that's leading the way in society or it mirrors society, but we're in a different place. And I'm mostly just really thankful for that.
Yeah, yeah. So one of your young adult novels, Out of the Pocket, talks about this, addresses this issue. It's about sports, it's about high school football, and it's also about LGBTQ issues. So I want to talk about that, but also kind of what took you in this young adult direction from being a sports writer for your entire career.
Sure. So I went to grad school here at Arizona State, and I didn't even know that young adult literature was a thing. I happened to be writing from a teen perspective, and I have a theory about that. I think that I was doing it because my coming out as a teenager was the most traumatic experience I'd had in my life. So I think we naturally gravitate to the place where there's the juice. So that's what I did. I wrote a book. I was writing from that perspective, and I heard that YA was a genre, and I thought, well, I should try this.
Yeah, and that was it? Simple as that? I should try it?
Simple as that, yeah.
And you've written several novels about this now in the young adult world, and you have a new one coming out now. So this is called The Music of What Happened. It's set here in the Valley, and it sounds like sort of a love story of opposites, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's a love story of opposites. What's really cool about it and what's new about it is that suddenly we have these books where the sexuality of the protagonists isn't the main focus. Mm. Like, I'm still old enough that when I started to write it, I was thinking about their coming out, but I realized in the process, it doesn't matter. Like, these are two out kids who are just having their life.
So do you think for the new generation, the younger generation of LGBTQ people, that like coming out is not this dramatic event like it was for you?
I think that it is still for many kids. And so we still have those stories, but we also have kids who wake up one morning and say, hey, mom, I think I'm bi or I think I'm gay. And the mother says, great, what would you like for breakfast? You know, so
things have changed.
Well,
okay.
Yeah. And I think that this is all about representation and kids being able to see themselves in books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell us about these characters.
So really these characters, Max and Jordan, are like two sides of myself. Max is a dude bro. And that's like back to my ESPN days. You know, I can talk that language. So
yeah.
Max is a baseball player. He has his buddies. They spend most of their time joking around. They never get too deep. Then there's Jordan, who is a drama kid and a poet, and he has his two girlfriends, and he's much more on the feminine side.
Mm-hmm.
And really, I think I wrote this book to be an exploration of masculinity and femininity and how we put ourselves together, because there are so many messages we get in this society about what a man is supposed to be. And so there's the obvious toxic ones like, you know, buck up, don't cry, that kind of stuff. And we know about that. And then on the other side, Jordan is getting messages about how he has to be funny and campy and all of this. And it's like, neither is great.
They're both stereotypes.
They're both stereotypes. So this is a book that avoids those stereotypes and brings them together and allows them to learn who they are more completely.
Yeah. So is this groundbreaking in the young adult world, this exploring LGBTQ issues and characters?
I think that it is groundbreaking, but not completely new. Mm-hmm. I think that when Out of the Pocket came out in 2008, there were maybe 15 or 20 books a year that came out on this topic. I think we're now at like 150 to 300, somewhere in that range.
Okay.
It's outrageous. So it isn't like it's brand new, but what's brand new is that it's not so unusual anymore.
Right. So it's almost not a subgenre anymore. It's just
right.
Part of the genre.
Right. Like my Out of the Pocket, I was in this world where, you know, gay kids who liked football, like those were that was my audience. So great. And now, I mean, mostly, I think, as much as anything else, straight kids as well as LGBTQ kids are reading my books.
Yeah, yeah. So what kind of feedback do you get from that audience? I mean, do you hear from those kids who are reading it and who really embrace it and thank you for it?
Yeah. Oh, boy. I love that. I mean, the best part of this job is that I get great emails.
Yeah.
And they run the gamut, you know, from people who want to take me to task for something to people who had never read a book with a gay character before.
Yeah.
And they want to express to me what it meant and what could be better than that.
Yeah. So what does it mean? I guess what do you hope it means when these young people read these books?
I think the best thing I could hope for would be for kids to think it's okay to be exactly who they are. Which sounds a little Mr. Rogers-y, I guess, but I think it's really important. I didn't have those books growing up. I didn't see myself in literature. And so in some ways, I am now I'm writing the books I wish that I could have read 30 years ago.
Fair enough. Okay. Bill Konigsberg, thank you so much for coming in.
Great. Thank you.
And look for Konigsberg talking about his new book later this month at Changing Hands Bookstore in Tempe.
On Roosevelt Row in Phoenix, a longtime staple, is closing on Sunday. Revolver Records, the downtown record shop, has been the center point for the First Friday Art Walk for about 10 years now. But owner T.J. Jordan announced in January Revolver was coming to an end.
Jordan said a few things made him come to the decision to close. The lease was ending. His life has changed, and the culture around him isn't what it used to be.
It got a little frustrating to me that we had worked really hard to create a place where people could go and experience music the way that I think it should be experienced. And sometimes it seemed like it got reduced to an Instagram post.
Some regulars have been going to the shop to say goodbye. Megan Elliott is one of them. She and had a friend in town from Texas and says she had to show her one of her favorite stops.
We wanted to go record shopping, and I told her we needed to come here definitely because they were closing.
Across the street, you can sit on the patio of Carly's Bistro and watch people come and go from the record store. Travis Fisher, a bartender and server, has been hanging out downtown for about a decade.
He says a lot of the local businesses seem to be moving out, but it's hard to tell if the change is for the better or the worse just yet.
Well, this area has definitely been big on the art community. I think the increase in rent and stuff, it's just kind of pushed a lot of those people into different areas. And now there's, like, condos here that weren't here a few years ago.
Revolver Records will be open until Sunday, so if you need to buy a few albums or even check it out, you better hurry. You have any vinyl, Lauren, at home?
I actually have an old record player that I bought and I use, which when my dad saw it, he said, that record player was a piece of crap in the 60s when it was built.
It's National Haiku Writing Month, and KJZZ's Weekend Edition host and poet in residence, Tom Maxidon, joins us now for an update on the show's haiku writing contest. It kicked off last week. There's also a new podcast called Word that explores the literary arts in the state and region. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Steve. That's right. We want listeners to continue submitting their haiku about Arizona. You can just go to the show.kjzz.org, and you'll see the details there underneath the top of the screen. And you can enter via social media, too. Lots of folks, you know, going to Twitter, Facebook, what have you, or email theshow@kjzz.org, and we'll select a winner each week, and we'll announce the first one shortly. But first, I sat down with Tomas Stanton with the Mesa Arts Center to talk about how spoken word, poetry, and even haiku is connecting to people's lives here in the Valley. And we should say Mesa Arts Center is an underwriter of programming on KJZZ. I opened up by asking Tomas about how poetry is touching the lives of Valley students.
We are just entered into our second semester of programming, and we'll be hosting our 7th annual Youth Poetry Festival in April. So that's pretty exciting as well.
There is a difference between just writing for the page and performing, and some folks are not necessarily comfortable getting up in front of an audience, right,
mm-hmm.
and performing their work. Or maybe the piece itself is too short, for instance, like in a haiku. They're very difficult to keep people's attention.
Mm-hmm.
And then vice versa, you know, sometimes you can kind of have folks who might get up there and maybe they just seem like they're going on a little bit too long. How do you strike the right balance?
We have a strict 5-minute time limit. And if you go over that time limit, our DJ and our musician will politely and respectfully fade you out, you know? And it's just a part of the culture there, you know, because we want to challenge folks to be able to try to look at language and the economy of language, right? And you have this story that could be a 15, 20-minute story,
right?
But, like, now you're challenged to fit that in a 5-minute time frame. You have to look at language a lot differently. You have to trim fat where you maybe wouldn't have. And have you ever heard of the haiku death match?
I have, yeah.
So this is a beautiful space where actually the haiku is the frontal point of the event. And it does challenge you as a writer to really consolidate what you're trying to say, to use that form in a very engaging, competitive way that keeps an audience on their toes. I've seen some amazing haiku death matches.
We're speaking with Tomas Stanton, who is Mesa Art Center's community engagement manager and also the co-producer of a storytelling and spoken word series. And boy, economy of language definitely is required for haiku. This is National Haiku Writing Month, NaHaRaiMo to abbreviate. And so we wanted to get people involved in the act of writing. Haiku, I would have to say, is definitely one of my favorite forms. And you have actually also incorporated it in your own teaching, correct?
Yeah. We host a competition. It's kind of one of the culminating events of our first semester of work at the Mesa Art Center. And it was a combination of three things that I felt were very valuable and I loved. And one of them is a national poetry competition called Poetry Out Loud, which allows students to pick a poem from an anthology that was written by another poet and to deconstruct that poem, to find the connections to their story in that poem. And then they perform it for an audience and they're judged. And, you know, it's a really great opportunity for students to be introduced to poetry in a really cool way, right? And then another thing that I really love is when we create opportunities for young folks to investigate their own lives through poetic narrative. And so this classic-ish slam has three rounds of poetry. One round is a Poetry Out Loud poem. The other round is a personal poetic narrative that they wrote and perform. And then the third round is a haiku, because for us, that haiku was kind of the icing on the cake for two reasons. One, three rounds of poetry can be very long, and you want to be able to keep everyone's attention. So that haiku is obviously a very condensed form of poetry, but also it challenges students to be able to really think critically about the economy of language and words. You know, how do you tell a story in 5-7-5? You know, like, how do you do it?
Right.
And I really enjoy writing haiku. It's a challenge for me. And so we introduced it to our students and they just took to it and loved it. And it's amazing to see what happens when they're challenged in that way.
Is there a haiku that comes to mind that you
yeah.
can think of?
One day I was sitting out on the porch during monsoon season with my dog, who I love. It was very meditative. It was a monsoon had just kind of finished. And so I wrote a poem. Obviously, in Arizona, we are very fortunate to enjoy the monsoon season. So this is a haiku about monsoons. Suffocated sun, slanted downpour thunderclaps, liquefied sidewalks.
Nice. I mean, you can see and hear all of that as if
somebody else was actually sitting on their front porch. That's awesome.
Thank you.
I'll return the favor. This is one that I came up with about Arizona. Coppered plane between curtain rod and window frame. Western light sandwich.
Nice. I love it.
And so I'm thinking about, though, that would be so hard to perform, I think, in any other space. You know, that how long did that take me to recite that? 15 seconds?
15 right? seconds at best, yeah. Unless, of course, it was, you know, a haiku death match. You know, I think yeah. you have to create a space that is specifically for haiku.
Well, we thank you for the space that you've created for enterprising writers of all ages with all of the things that you've done there as a community engagement manager. Tomas Stanton, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Me. Appreciate it.
And you can hear the full interview with Tomas Stanton at word.kjzz.org. That's our new podcast focusing on the literary arts in the state and the region.
And now, Tom, a phrase I never thought I'd say on the show, breaking haiku news. You have a winner to announce.
That's right. 75 listeners sent in a haiku, and we drew a name this morning, and the winner this week is Jason Lee, who sent this haiku through Twitter. Here's the poem Jason submitted. Heat of angered God burns down upon wretched souls. Welcome to Phoenix.
Yes, as an almost native, I can agree with that. Congratulations to Jason. Thanks for sharing your poem with the show. Tom, thank you also for being here.
Thanks.
And you too have the opportunity to submit a haiku about Arizona. Email the show at kjzz.org or share your haiku on Twitter with hashtag Arizona Haiku. If you submitted a haiku this past week, you can enter again with another haiku. We'll choose a random winner next Friday morning from that week's submissions, and you, the winner, will receive a special KJZZ item. And Tom, also, the selection of some of our favorite haiku on our website, theshow.kjzz.org. Tom Maxidon, host of our new podcast, Word. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks.
All right, Steve, so the 61st Grammy Awards are this Sunday, where all the past year's best music will be recognized.
Now, I'm sure you're surprised, Lauren, that I know Kendrick Lamar leads with 8 nominations, including Album of the Year, Song of the Year, Record of the Year, for his song All the Stars, which was featured in the Black Panther movie.
I'm not at all surprised by that. You are very cool. So Drake follows with 7 nominations for God's Plan, a song and a music video that went viral last year after Drake went around Miami donating the nearly $1 million that was budgeted for the music video.
And like last year, a lot of focus on female artists. Last year, only 17 of the 86 winners were women. This year, eyes are on Cardi B, Lady Gaga, Brandi Carlile, and Kacey Musgraves.
I love Kacey Musgraves. 15-time Grammy Award-winning artist Alicia Keys will be hosting the award show, and you can expect performances throughout the night. But a lot of the big names have denied to perform. Drake, Childish Gambino, Ariana Grande, and Kendrick Lamar have all announced they won't be on stage.
But there is one thing to look forward to as well, a tribute to Aretha Franklin that they'll be doing. That should be really interesting and moving as well.
All right. You are listening to the show here on KJZZ.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.